but was rather distracted by a naked feline footpaw running up and down my leg under the table. I shot a couple of warning glances at Ames, but the feline only smiled toothily at me. Once he got over his shyness, Leeson had a dozen questions, most of them directed at Toby. The theatrical minotaur was more than happy to tell his tales. I tried to concentrate on the paladin's words, but those curious werecat toes crept higher on my leg until... I jumped in my seat, bumping the table hard with a knee. I practically growled, "Excuse us." My meaty green hand found Ames' shoulder. The feline had slipped those mischievous toes back into their boot, just in time to be dragged off. The only study that was accomplished that night involved pleasure thresholds and the structural integrity of the university's bed frames. Somewhat ill-rested, but far more relaxed, I showed up for the morning study session. Once again, no Max. There was a thick, somewhat singed log leaning against one of the stone walls. Miraculously, desks had been moved and the room had been tidied up somewhat so that nothing would catch fire, the task probably completed by the hands of overworked students. The slate board simply said, "Dry runs, no material components, don't hurt the log." I was to execute the verbal and somatic components of the lightning bolt spell without using the brass or fur. About an hour into practice, Max showed up. As he walked by with his mug, I caught the scent of wine rather than coffee. I commented, "Isn't it a little early for that?" "No," was the flat reply. I sighed and went back to my drills. After watching me for almost the entire morning session, the aged mage commented, "Your form is good. It's a tragic waste, of course." The mixed compliment and insult gave me pause. I shook out the tension in my calloused hands and asked, "A waste?" Max nodded. "Think about it. A high percentage of your power has to be dedicated to overcoming what amounts to a racial defect. A portion of the spells that you memorize will always be to artificially boost your intelligence. The drain exists on the financial, mental, and paraphysical levels. If I was teaching anyone other than yourself, 100% of the effort would be reflected in the result. With you, it will always be this absurd juggling act. Hells, without that amulet you wear, you're useless. In essence, I'm just giving you the ability to drain your intellect even faster, which means you need to dedicate more resources to enhancing it, and so on and so on. It's a downward spiral, and a waste." I nodded slowly. His logic was flawless. Nothing he said was strictly wrong. I was at a disadvantage, and there was nothing that turned it into an advantage in any way. "So what's next?" I asked. The Master Mage shrugged.
"Well, I suppose you could start a little business somewhere. Perhaps become a night watchman with a magical bent? Something non-taxing that would make use of your limited talents?"
I shook my head. "No, I mean..." I picked up the rod of brass and swatch of fur from my desk. A few moments later, the room was filled with a thunderclap as my lightning bolt crashed into the log, setting it ablaze in the process. "What's next?" The elderly Magus and I stared at each other for a few long moments. Finally, he answered,
"Put out the damned fire, then lunch."
We had an extra half day to master Max's message. My confidence soared. I had gained an understanding of Max's magical vocabulary, and I had to admit that I was a much better magic user because of it. I tackled the afternoon session with a renewed vigor. I learned that Max's message sacrificed duration for range. In fact, through a brilliant modification of standard psychic contact magic, the range of Max's spell was infinite. If you kept the number of words to 24 or less, and assuming you had personal knowledge of the target, you could send a message to any intelligent creature anywhere on Panos. They could then respond with the exact same restrictions. Anything above 24 words, however, and the spell fizzled. That was the trade-off. Max's message used a braid of copper wire as the material component. As I had blacksmiths cutting up my copper coins all the time, this was yet another task for them. Luckily, my copper supply was quite large at this point. The next few days were intense, but for me, the result was never in question. Leeson was thriving in this environment, and I had it on good authority from Professor Dunn that the lad was going to pass with flying colors. As for myself, I kept a healthy sleep and study schedule, save for the night prior to my final test. I figured that Ames was such a good luck charm last time. Sacrificing a little bit of sleep for a little bit of entertainment and relaxation was the only logical, responsible thing to do. The werecat was probably somewhat shocked and flustered when, in the early afternoon of the last day, a colorful and ribald suggestion suddenly popped into their head. To be honest, I wasn't certain if Ames even owned a whip. Luckily, the string of curses that the feline responded with was less than 24 words. Max made me cast the spell again with him as the target to confirm that everything was working properly. I sent him the message. The reason I did this was to become a better person. Don't think of it as a waste. I certainly don't. The response that I got was a very neutral, "I received the message." Without a word to me, Master Max picked up his quill, dipped it in ink, and jotted down a short note on a torn scrap of parchment. He slipped it into an envelope and sealed it. The master's signet ring was pressed into the hardening wax.
"Take this with you when you go to see the headmaster. Let's clean up the final details in your spellbook and be done with this foolishness!"
Max did have some good points to add to my process. As with the other spells that he had examined in my spellbook, the margins of the pages were quickly being filled with small modifications and interesting details. As I was finishing my final notes, Max struck up a conversation, which was unusual for him.
"It's a shame that you don't have the kind of time and resources required to make a better version of your spell. Something more efficient."
I gave him a look that must have conveyed what I was thinking. "Why are you telling me this, old man?" The venerable old codger continued,
"My next research project happens to be called Max's Mental Magnification. Of course, the scope of it is beyond your feeble grasp of magic, at least presently. But while you were sleeping, I took the liberty of learning the little party trick that you created. It's cute."
I paused in my writing to stare at him. "You stole my spell?" Max snorted.
"Call it a trade. Because if you survived that long, and if you can afford the gold-based material component for Max's mental magnification, well, who better to test it on than a simpleton such as yourself?"
I couldn't find words. This sort of unexpected kindness, even if couched in a massive backhanded insult, was the last thing I would have anticipated.
"This is assuming, by some miracle, that you find yourself attending this fine establishment, instead of being propelled ass-first into the swamp that you came from. I expect the latter, but who knows?"
With that, Max rose and slowly made his way out of the classroom. He called over his shoulder,
"Clean up after you're done, and make sure you collect all of your belongings on the way out, including that letter. I'm locking up in half an hour regardless."
And with that, Max was gone. I kept my appointment with Hematath, dutifully delivering the note from Max. After taking both a seat and a cookie at the headmaster's behest, I watched as the elven archmage opened the envelope. She chuckled at the contents. Seeing my curiosity, Hematath handed over the very brief note. It read simply, "Send more like this." The old elven mage noted,
"That's the nicest thing Max has said about a student in the past 20 years, believe it or not. Anyway, the results of your assessment will be sent in the next few weeks, courtesy of the spell that you just learned. We need to rate you against those vying for similar positions within the Arcane University. However, feedback so far has been quite positive."
I handed Max's note back to the headmaster. "Thank you for the opportunity and for your kindness." Hematath waved it off as nothing with one pale hand.
"Of course. Now, if you're so inclined, I would like to invite you and your friends to a private dinner."
I nodded. "Of course, headmaster." She explained,
"The invitation is somewhat selfish, if I'm being honest. I have some business that I would like to discuss. Would you be so kind as to round up your group, pack your things, and say goodbye to your roommate?"
I stood quickly. "Right away."
"Thank you. I'll see you in 2 hours."
Chapter 14. I gathered my things from room 214, got another big bear hug from Leeson as a parting gift, and then went to join my companions at dinner. On my way through the reception hall, I stopped by the university bank. They confirmed that my account had been approved and that Rick had already made a deposit in the amount of my remaining share. Access to the money, from any branch, throughout all of Panos, was controlled by the same identity anklet that was used on the school grounds. The headmaster's private dining area was an elegant little room. Padded redwood chairs surrounded an oval table made of granite. There was a shuttered serving hatch that bridged the kitchen and the dining area, allowing food to be passed through quickly and efficiently. A cheese course was followed by a lovely vegetarian stew. The main dish was venison served with butter-fried potatoes, which sounded too rich for my tastes. I was happy to be proven wrong, of course. The headmaster seemed content to allow each of us to tell our best adventuring stories during dinner. She was particularly interested in my tale about the silverfish. It was a story that I didn't often tell, as I felt it might upset my friends to hear about how I had gambled with my life. There was more than one thoughtful and concerned face by the time I was done, but at least it had a happy ending. Hematath waited until the vanilla sponge cake had been served before getting down to business.
I want to thank you all for coming. As I get older and older, I find that my friends seem to get younger and younger. That's a good thing. When I took this position at the Arcane University, I swore that I would not allow things to stagnate. It was this pledge that caused us to increase funding towards exploration, recovery, and bounties of all sorts. But I never expected to personally meet and come to care about dozens of our adventuring brethren. So before I make my pitch to your fine group, let us raise our wine glasses. To the spirit of adventure.
Did I mention the wine? It was good wine. After the toast, Hematath said,
So, I am a representative of both magical education as well as the will of the collective elven lands. The North and the South don't agree on much, but one thing the elves of both Sevilia and Arbitros agree on is the concept of stability. Revolution by the people is one thing, but the overthrowing of a government by violence perpetrated from within is quite another matter. In short, we're not fans of treachery. That's the topic of tonight's proposal.
The headmaster gestured towards the wall, and an illusion flickered to life. A great walled city by the sea appeared. In the center, a palace flying blue banners.
This is Royal Moffat. You know it as the human capital of the Southlands. King Wensley Rosen and Queen Ginger Rosen contacted me urgently about 2 weeks ago. They had caught a spy in their court talking about the downfall of Royal Moffat. They might have dismissed him as a madman if it were not for the man's ridiculously well-funded efforts and his extensive use of magic to remain hidden.
I glanced around, not really knowing the regional politics involved. Everyone else was solemn-faced. I followed suit.
As I believe that Toby had intended to lead his order's efforts at the upcoming anniversary celebrations in Royal Moffat, this assignment would put you in the right place at the right time. We would like you all to meet with the royal family, as well as Duke Harrington, advisor to the Crown and controller of the Harrington Fiefdom. Provide any assistance to the investigation that you can. I'm authorized to offer a guaranteed minimum payment of 1,000 gold coins per week.
There was a murmured discussion amongst our group. I was perfectly willing to help with the research, and it seemed like all of us felt that this was too important and lucrative to pass up. When the crosstalk died down, the headmaster noted,
Toby is our preferred public face for this mission. His connection to both the elves and to the Order of the Snow makes him a figure beyond reproach in matters such as this, and we trust him to report back to us while maintaining the appropriate amount of discretion.
The big bull rumbled, I'm honored, headmaster. I'll do my best.
The aged elven woman continued, However, in the background and in secret, it is our unanimous preference that Sorch sets the direction for this investigation.
All eyes turned towards me in surprise. If I weren't sitting where I was, my eyes would have also turned towards me in surprise. I managed an eloquent, What in the hells? Hematath quickly explained,
Sorch, your dreams directly coincide with increased portents of disaster from some of the most talented divination experts and religious leaders in the Elven lands. They all see something that threatens the world, a seed that is being planted as we speak, or perhaps one that has already been planted. Your specific version of these portents might apply to your orc tribe, but there's a broader theme. The one detail that our people have that you do not is the location where it all starts. Royal Moffat.
The headmaster gestured towards the wall and the illusion flickered. Soon the image was zoomed in on the castle.
Specifically, Moffat Palace. We need you there, with your eyes and ears open, and we need your friends surrounding you to provide guidance, protection, and support. I wish I could be more specific, Sorch, but I cannot. I can only say that if you want to prevent the disaster that befalls the Jawafa tribe within your dream, this might be your best opportunity.
I drained my wine glass. Then I nodded. I'll do it. If my friends are all in agreement. There was nodding all around the table. The headmaster seemed to hesitate, but then asked,
I am glad that you're willing. However, there is a matter I've been asked to clarify. Your answer might impact your suitability. I'm sorry to have to ask this, Sorch. It is a rather private matter, and I don't want to tamper with how others experience divinity. But the High Priestess wanted me to find out. Did you speak directly to Ami Suteth?
Somewhat bashfully, as I had only shared the experience with Ames, I admitted, Yes. Will threw a spoon at me. He missed.
What the heck, Sorch?
Toby and Rick were also staring at me in disbelief, though they had enough self-control to avoid hurling silverware. Our elven hostess nodded slowly.
It's okay. Would you explain the vision, or as much as you're comfortable with?
I cleared my throat. Well, we talked about stuff and things. I apologized on behalf of my people and Kenvunk. She called me Stonebreaker, and then Stone Mender. We spoke about dropping the whole curse against my race, but she said first I had to mend what I had broken and we would see. Hematath looked confused.
So it was more of a personal conversation? With a goddess?
I did my best to look humble. I guess. The old elven mage shook her head.
I'll relay that back to the High Priestess of Ami Suteth. Thank you. I don't see how that would hamper your leadership of the mission, so that's fine.
Once again addressing the entire group, Hematath said,
I have a teleportation crew ready to send you to Royal Moffat tonight. If you have any affairs that need sorting, please write them down and I'll transport runners to Limpt and Icehouse to have things taken care of in your absence. If the tasks involve an advance on your payment, that's fine. Please enjoy your wine. I'll go make arrangements with the innkeeper at the Drowsy Dragon. He's a personal friend.
When the elf had departed, I got a grilling about keeping my vision from Toby and Will and Rick. But as I explained to them, I might have been going mad for all I knew at the time. I didn't know for sure if it was real. And Ames was so casual about it, I said in my own defense. The werecat shrugged.
I was pretty tired. Honestly, I was only half listening. I thought it was a ploy to get in my pants again.
Rick cradled his forehead in his hands.
And these are the people who are watching my back. Spectacular!
In the end, my explanation seemed to mollify my friends. Even Will, who had been hurt that I wouldn't share such a thing with him after everything else we had talked about, granted me his forgiveness. They seemed to understand my hesitation, but urged me to share such revelations in the future. The servants cleared away our plates. They passed around parchment, ink, and quills so that we could write down any matters that we needed to have taken care of in our absence. I jotted down details on my landlord so that I would be paid up through the next couple of weeks. I also stipulated that 25% of my fee was to be sent to Shaman via my preferred courier. The rest could be deposited into my account. With that done, we gathered up our gear and headed down to the teleporter. At this time of night, there were very few people in the reception hall area. The headmaster was waiting for us. Hematath handed Toby a slip of parchment.
Give this to Ashley for me. It's confirmation that your instay is covered for the next 2 weeks. Good luck.
To my surprise, Hematath stood up on tiptoes, and Toby crouched until the elf could kiss the Minotaur on the cheek. Then we were ushered onto the metal transport circle. A few moments later, and we were elsewhere. It was as if the gazebo from Ice House had been transplanted in a far warmer climate. The night was too dark to see a lot of details, but this was almost certainly the rear yard of the Temple of Amisuteth in Royal Moffat. A lone attendant quickly led us to the back gate, warning us that a storm was brewing. Once outside, Rick asked,
"Do we know where this inn is?"
Toby said,
"Yes, follow me. Quickly."
Our version of quick wasn't quick enough. The sky opened up. Raindrops the size of blueberries pelted us as we ran for the drowsy dragon. Five hardened adventurers were soon sprinting down the cobblestone street because instinct told us that getting wet was unacceptable. Ames started laughing breathlessly. It was infectious. Soon we were all losing our stride and our breath because none of us could keep up the brisk pace while howling with mirth at the absurdity of it all. We half-jogged, half-staggered into the main room of the drowsy dragon. As things were quiet, we did our best to mute our chortling so as not to disturb other customers. The front room was simple but orderly. Seven ornately carved stools sat in front of the maplewood bar. The oval tables and large high-backed chairs that were placed throughout the taproom were made of a less expensive cedar, but they were still plenty sturdy. A tall, slender elf walked up to us. He was dressed all in brown, save for a dusty white apron. He murmured,
"Our friends from the Arcane University, I assume?"
Toby unslung his pack and dug deeply until he produced the message from the headmaster. He shook the folded parchment open with his offhand. It was mostly dry. The Minotaur then held out a dripping golden brown furred hand for shaking.
"Ashley, I presume. I'm Toby, and these are my compatriots. Oh, here. I hope it stayed dry enough."
Ashley shook the paladin's hand, then folded and pocketed the message without reading it.
"I'm sure everything is in order. Only the small rooms are available, but we have three of them, and they're dry, at least."
We thanked the slim elf, took the keys that were offered, and headed upstairs. The top floor of the inn was simple but charming. A light pine varnish coated the walls and floor, allowing the staff to keep things meticulously clean. Toby got a room to himself, Ames and I shared, and Will and Rick took the last room. The feline and I got dry as soon as possible. Within minutes, we were snuggled together under the blankets of our generously sized bed. The two of us fell asleep soon after. The morning arrived far too soon, but preparations needed to be made. As the mages, myself included, went through their memorizations, our two less arcane-oriented members were hard at work. Toby arranged for a messenger to formally announce our imminent arrival to the royal court. Ames stealthily spied on the palace itself. Comings and goings, guard strength and equipment, best observation points, and the like. As I was casting my final morning intelligence enhancement, the big paladin returned. He waited until the incantation was done and then spoke.
"All right, that should satisfy protocol. Let's aim to arrive in about 1 hour. We can pick up Ames on the way. We had breakfast already. You go ahead and grab something to eat. I'll let the human lads know."
He ducked out to tell Rick and Will what was going on. Breakfast at the Drowsy Dragon was simple fare. Sausages, toasted bread, and apple juice. Still, it was a feast compared to what I was eating just a few months ago. I finished my meal, then went to the water pump and washed my hands and face. I had to look good for my first royal appearance. Royal Moffat was a huge city, easily 5 times the size of Limpt. The architecture was a little more boring, however. More uniform. Limpt was more quaint and quirky, and this place certainly didn't hold a candle to the crystalline and cave-like features in Ice House. Instead, almost everything was made of red brick or gray stone blocks. Nearly every building was 2 stories tall. The only structure that was dramatically different was the one we were heading towards. Moffat Palace was monumental. Not counting the courtyard, which had the footprint of several city blocks, the palace itself was best described as towering. The four corner towers, in fact, were each 11 floors high. They were functional rather than ornamental, meaning that each circular floor had a rather wide radius so that it could host a large kitchen, a series of bedrooms, an armory, just about any kind of room that one might imagine. The central palace had a broad footprint, and although it wasn't as tall as the surrounding towers, it did have 7 floors of functional space, plus a basement and a dungeon. As we turned onto Royal Avenue, Ames slid out of an alley and smoothly fell into step with the rest of the group. The feline took up the rear guard position as we approached the front gatehouse. Toby walked up to the sergeant of the watch and shook his hand warmly. Whether the Minotaur knew the large ebony-skinned human, or whether it was a display of professional courtesy, I didn't know. Sergeant Archie Lee then introduced himself to each of us. He made sure to let us know that if there were any day-to-day security questions, he would be happy to answer them. After pleasantries had been exchanged, we were escorted through the courtyard, down several stately halls, and into the throne room. Although there were hints of opulence here and there, the royal family had chosen not to flaunt their undeniable wealth. Paintings of past kings and queens rested upon the walls, held snugly in gold gilt frames. Wrought iron crystal chandeliers illuminated the main chamber, aided by the occasional torch held in silver wall sconces. A red pile-knotted carpet stretched from the entry doors all the way to the steps of the stately metallic thrones. Today was a closed session of the royal court, meaning only pre-approved individuals could be in attendance. Normally there would be a screening room to see if petitioner concerns were worthy of royal attention, an open gallery where select people could watch but not participate, a closed gallery where worthy petitioners waited to be heard, and a royal gallery where those of noble blood could sit, watch, and participate if they so chose. However, in a closed session, there was only a royal gallery with perhaps a dozen nobles in attendance, and a short queue of officials and ambassadors waiting for their time in front of the royal family. Upon seeing us enter, a white-wigged man sitting upon the large central throne of steel held up one hand. The merchant who had been speaking shut up immediately.
"Seal the room behind our honored guests, please. There will be a pause in entry until after their issues have been addressed," said the king.
King Wensley Rosen was not as old as his powdered wig might indicate. In his mid-30s, the man's voice was robust, powerful. He seemed confident, hale, and in his prime. Queen Ginger Rosen, sitting on a smaller throne at her husband's left side, glanced up when that order was issued. A brilliant smile was aimed in our direction, brief but sincere. The powdered wig on her head did nothing to hide her own youth, which was also betrayed by the young son and daughter playing at her feet. The merchant continued his petition as the doors behind us were chained. We were offered refreshments. In days past, it might have been whole fruit from the gardens, but not even royalty was spared from the changes in climate. Instead, chilled pear juice and honey-roasted cashew nuts were the snacks of choice. We accepted, of course. It's not a good idea to reject royal hospitality even so soon after breakfast. In about half an hour, the last petitioner ahead of us was finishing up. She was asking for additional patrols on the northern roads to reduce incidents of highway robbery. The matter was approved for further study and handed off to the finance minister to work out a budget proposal. Our group stepped forward when the petitioning area was vacated. The other four knelt on one knee before the royal family. I caught on quickly, and was only a split second behind the rest of the group. Only the queen seemed to notice, flickering her amber eyes towards me. A small, secret smile that conveyed both amusement and reassurance was sent my way. I immediately felt more relaxed. The king stood and proclaimed,
"Rise, please, friends. Ladies and gentlemen of the court, if it pleases you as much as it pleases us, heartily greet the representatives of the Arcane University."
As we stood, there was a healthy amount of applause given such a small audience. King Wensley waited for the clapping to die down, and then he said,
"Sadly, the matters about to be discussed are not for the whole court.
I would ask that the Security Council members remain. Would everyone else proceed to the foyer? Today, I believe that we have Sara Turu, court cellist, waiting to entertain you during this pause in normal proceedings. As the nobility and extra staff filed out, the royal children, probably aged about 4 years for the girl and 5 for the boy, squealed and ran over to Ames. They practically climbed all over the werecat. The bewildered rogue was gently tugged over to sit on the step just below the queen's throne. All this amidst comments and questions like,
"Beautiful. So soft. Do you like horses? Pretty tail."
Queen Ginger murmured, amused,
"Amanda, Bo, this is our esteemed guest, Ames. Ames, these are the rather outgoing royal children. I hope you'll pardon them. We don't see many werecats this far south. May I invite you to tea so that you can be properly acquainted with them afterwards?"
Amidst face and ears being gently stroked, Ames rumbled,
"Of course, Your Highness." "Thank you. Children, our guest is joining us for tea in a while. Will you run and tell the steward?"
The lad and Lass cheered, and after sneaking in a couple more pets on the big kitty, they raced out of the throne room. The doors were closed behind the departing children. Ames quickly hopped up and rejoined the rest of us. The king smiled at us. "Well, always an adventure, isn't it?" We all had a chuckle. Then the monarch gestured at each of the 2 remaining nobles standing in the royal gallery as they were announced. "Allow me to introduce General Stanish Colton, head of Army Intelligence." Stanish was a silver-haired gent, but his fine white silk shirt did very little to hide corded muscles that were still formidable after half a century. He wore leathers similar to what Ames wore for adventuring, preferring high mobility over the raw protection of metal armors. On his belt hung a long sword and a short sword. Even in the bright light of the throne room, the rubies inlaid upon their hilts glowed with a magical aura. I could already see the man dual-wielding those 2 fine weapons in my mind. In that mental scenario, I was on his side, of course. "And allow me to introduce Duke Marley Harrington, personal advisor to the royal family." Duke Harrington wore a neutral expression throughout his introduction. Although he looked to be in his mid-40s, certain aspects of the Duke's countenance seemed almost youthful. His curly brown hair looked like it was in need of a trim. His blue eyes were sharp and attentive, but clearly the man had been in some kind of accident or had been injured 1 or more times. His left arm was missing at the shoulder. Patches of his skin looked like they suffered from burns at some point. When I walked in, I had also noticed a scar that ran down the back of his neck. He was dressed entirely in gold and crimson, clothes doubtlessly custom-tailored for his disability. "As I noted to your headmaster, the Duke will be your liaison in this matter. He is up to date with every detail of the case. Marley, would you present the facts of the incident?" All eyes turned towards the Duke, situated to our right.
"Thank you, Your Highness," said Duke Harrington, each word careful, almost overpronounced. "Welcome, representatives of the lauded Arcane University. Exactly 12 nights ago, we uncovered a spy in our midst. He was attempting to recruit one of our dungeon laborers into a plot that, apparently, involved the partial or complete destruction of this palace."
He paused for effect, then resumed.
"If this had been any normal man, it would have ended there. Madness and delusions of grandeur have claimed more than one soul, after all. However, this man was using illusions to remain hidden, and had a rather high-priced cover. He was posing as visiting nobility, lifestyle included. Given the mystical nature of this, we contacted your people, and here we are."
Rick started the questioning. "You said illusions. They were detected at some point?" The Duke shrugged.
"He attempted to use them in the course of being discovered and trying to escape, such as invisibility, and such as an illusionary wall that one could simply walk through. He was unsuccessful in the end."
I asked, "Why recruit a dungeon worker?" Duke Harrington turned his gaze to me sharply. He paused a moment, then admitted,
"We don't know. Our theory is that he was planning to free one of our more dangerous prisoners. He would have several to choose from that share his wish, assuming that he ultimately desired the downfall of the royal family."
Ames gave a little head tilt.
"When can we see him?"
"You cannot. He died during interrogation 2 days ago. I assure you he was quite healthy when the session started, and nothing was done to him beyond mental tactics and mild irritation. Suddenly, mid-question, he was gone. The court surgeon is trying to discover why, but having no luck."
We looked at each other, then Rick stated, "Not much to go on." The Duke shrugged.
"Indeed."
Stanish piped in, his somewhat breathy voice almost sliding over the silence in the room.
"I'll make all of my people available to you as you require. All of the security reports from the last few months will be at your command. Rest assured, you have our support."
King Wensley nodded. "Thank you, gentlemen." Then he addressed the group. "We hope that your magical talents can aid this investigation, but we understand if there are simply too few clues. Paladin McGoldberg, I believe you said you're staying at the Drowsy Dragon? Guest quarters will also be made available to you here, in the palace. The Southwest Tower, level 4, will house your entire group in comfort, should you require. It will not be assigned to anyone else for the duration of your investigation. Use the area as you see fit."
Toby bowed to the king. "Thank you, Your Highness. It will be most useful as a staging and rest area."
The queen called over,
"Dear Ames, would you please escort me to tea?"
The feline handed their backpack to Toby and then padded over to Queen Ginger. The human looped her arm through Ames's, as if being escorted to a formal dance. My favorite werecat shot a brief look over their shoulder, as if begging me for help. I just smiled broadly. The two walked out of the room using the same exit as the children had used minutes before. Two well-armed guards followed. King Wensley smiled at the four of us remaining. "We'll leave you to it, then. Thank you, one and all," he called out.
"We shall resume in 10 minutes. Please inform the court."
The side doors were opened, the rear doors unchained, and cello music flooded in from the foyer. The four of us bowed and took our leave. The Southwest Tower was actually quite a walk from the center of the palace. 8 minutes of hallways and stairs later, and we were in the privacy of our own chambers. It was an open barracks, complete with kitchen and pantry, taking up the entirety of the tower floor. The area was functional, but not fancy. The pantry had been stocked with bread, hard cheese, and a few jars of preserved peaches in syrup. There were 12 single beds and as many footlockers. Although not strictly palatial, one could do much worse. We split up and blanketed every room with detect magic. There were no hits other than the items in our possession that we knew to be magical. Toby searched for secret and trap doors, but found nothing. The first thing I did after the sweep was turn to Will.
"Okay, spill."
The small human looked surprised.
"What? How did you know?"
I snorted.
"Because you kept your mouth shut. Since when does that happen? What did you see?"
The mage huffed, but admitted,
"I didn't see anything as such, but something doesn't add up. If something they were doing in interrogation, fairly non-violent by the sounds of it, killed this spy, why did it take 10 days? So he keels over 2 days ago, likely just after our headmaster proposed a plan. Why? Natural causes. No way."
Toby considered the options, pacing up and down the long aisle between the rows of beds.
"Poisoned? Maybe magically assassinated?"
Rick noted grimly.
"If other illusionists were involved, there's a powerful spell called the Phantom Killer. It would leave no marks. Only the victim would have seen it. He would have had to willingly believe in it, given his situation, but if he wanted to die before he broke..."
That grim thought hung in the air for quite a while. We unpacked our own things and started to get organized. I was unpacking for Ames in the werecat's absence when the door opened. I called over,
"We think we might have some ideas."
"So do we,"
was the reply. Ames entered, but was followed by a slim, cloaked figure. Only when she threw off her hood did we all realize we were standing in the presence of royalty. There was a chorus of bowing, kneeling, and recitations of Your Majesty, but the Queen was having none of it.
No, no, stop. Y'all don't have to do that now. There isn't time. Call me Ginger and get me some of them peaches and a fork.
The jarring country inflection of Her Royal Highness was quite a shock, but I gathered my wits and headed out to the kitchen. Everyone followed and planted themselves in chairs around the huge wooden table. I put the requested items in front of our royal visitor. Ginger said,
I want to thank Ames here for being my cover. The kids do like you, sugar, and I hope you like the tea. But I gotta tell y'all, I think Harrington is full of sheep crap.
She grabbed the jar, popped it open, and speared one of the sweet peach chunks with a fork before devouring it. Toby cleared his throat.
Your high... Ginger, you think we're being lied to?
The royal ragamuffin shrugged.
Can't rightly say lying. Maybe just hiding the whole truth. Either way, he isn't the only spy in town. Got me my own people and had him followed. Most of it was boring, but last week he ended up meeting with the Bishop of Koroth. Never heard of his family having ties there.
Ames didn't get the reference.
Koroth?
I shook my head, not knowing either. Will fielded that one.
Koroth the Broker is the demon who negotiated the great wager amongst the gods and the architect of the contract banning angels and demons from setting foot on Panos.
Rick asked Ginger, what would his motive be? The Queen gestured around with a fork dripping with syrup.
Everything. Enough of the royal family dies, his line takes over. Harrington was heir to the biggest fiefdom in the kingdom when his folks died. Reckon we might be next.
I considered. We're supposed to report to him. Ginger shook her head, strawberry blonde curls bouncing around. She downed another peach slice, then tapped her fork on the edge of the open jar.
Y'all now report to me. You tell that snake a whole lot of nothing. No real progress, still fleshing out leads. I'll square it with my girl Hemi, don't worry.
We had a brief discussion as to our next move, but before we came to a decision, the Queen stood up. She handed Will her fork and then pulled up her hood again.
I gotta get back. Keep me informed.
Ginger? I called.
Yeah?
Your formal accent is amazing. She laughed.
You know, honey, I was gonna say the same thing to you.
And with that, the most powerful woman in the land left, breath smelling of preserved peaches. All right, I said. The Temple of Koroth is our next stop, but we need to put on a good show for the royal court. Suggestions? Rick said,
the dungeon is an easy way to kill a day's worth of investigation. Look into why the worker was approached, and at the same time examine the interrogation room.
Toby chimed in.
Koroth demands midnight services during the week, so assuming this temple follows the same traditions as others I've seen, we'll be able to say we're going back to the Drowsy Dragon before slipping out to attend.
Ames had been murmuring to Will. The small human nodded to the feline, then said aloud,
And we'll likely be followed. I'll take care of obfuscating us magically, and Ames can cover our physical traces.
I was satisfied with the details. Good. Toby will handle explaining our fake plan to them. Since we're actually going to investigate the dungeon, he won't be lying. We will go back to the dragon first to wait for an hour and make sure we weren't followed. So again, no lying there. The three arcane casters will get some rest and prepare for the worst. After our midday spell memorization, we requested access to the dungeon. General Colton assigned a pair of his men to hold torches, answer questions, and watch our backs as we examined the palace's depths. Local guides were always welcome. It was an afternoon of slow discovery. The dungeons had no obvious escape route, no secret passages. There were only tiny grates that led to the sewer, and each was bolted down tightly. If the intention was to free one or more prisoners, they would need to travel back up the heavily guarded stairway. The interrogation room was a dead end as well. There was no magical item or mystical presence that would enhance the stress levels of the captured spy to the point of a heart attack. We headed back to our private tower floor to discuss the results. After a quick sweep with detect magic to make sure that no mystical forces were listening, I put our plans into motion. Let's pack everything up and take it all with us. We don't know what would be tampered with. Toby, You can make the report to the Duke on the way out. While the Minotaur set up our entirely truthful smokescreen, we gathered at the palace's main exit. Once Toby was finished, the five of us headed back to the inn. Dinner was had, then the surveillance started. We had picked up a tail. After an hour of observing the spy, we estimated that he was working alone. Will asked me, "What do we want to do about him?" I considered, "Ames, scare the piss out of him." I never got the exact details, but 20 minutes later our feline companion returned. The werecat was grinning toothily.
"He won't be back tonight," Ames assured us.
At 11:15, we set out towards the western part of the city, keeping to the back alleys. All of us were sporting long black cloaks to help us blend in when we reached our destination. They would also help with the ruse that we had planned in advance to avoid being followed. As the five of us turned a corner, Rick quickly cast a simple spell by the name of Audible Illusion. It created a phantom sound that traveled in any direction of the caster's choosing. In this case, the sound of our party walking and chattering with each other was sent down the opposite alley. As quickly and quietly as we could, we weaved down two tight bends in rapid succession. 10 minutes later, Will cast the same spell, and we did it all over again in a different alley. If we were being followed before, it was far less likely now. We arrived at the Temple of Koroth at 5 minutes till midnight. It was a smaller temple, able to handle around 75 parishioners. 9 rows of pews were split up the middle to form a central aisle. Including us, only about 35 people were in attendance. We blended in well. Traditional garb for worshippers of Koroth was black on more black. Stoically, we listened to the sermon of Koroth. He wasn't a full god as such, more of a powerful demon lord or underworld demigod for those interested in greed, merciless negotiation, and advantageous accords. The theme of the night seemed to be about getting revenge in quasi-legal and profitable ways. I was afraid that Toby would snap at some point, but he seemed fairly neutral. That look was not uncommon on the face of a Minotaur that was simply bored. At the end of the half-hour service, the congregation was dismissed. Most people headed out via the front entryway, but a select few walked past the altar to disappear behind a partition at the rear of the apse. Ames stealthily made their way towards the front of the temple to see what was happening there. The rest of us stayed kneeling in the pew, praying. In minutes, we were the only people left in the nave area. Just as I was starting to get restless, there was a loud thump and a hissed curse. Quickly we stood and made our way towards the area behind the apse. Ames was standing, looking down at the weakly groaning heap of human flesh writhing on the ground. The werecat held a heavy, slightly bloody candle holder in their paws. Defensively, the cat murmured,
"I didn't know the password."
Quickly, we bound and gagged the guard that our friend had waylaid. He had a minor scalp wound, but he looked like he would be all right in a couple of hours. Ames relieved the poor man of his keys, and we opened up the sacristy. A quick search of the ritual preparation area unveiled exactly nothing out of the ordinary. We were about to beat a hasty retreat when Toby stopped us. His keen Minotaur senses had ferreted out a tunnel behind the wall of a vestment closet. Ames found the intervening secret door and made quick work of the opening mechanism. Stone steps, illuminated by recently lit and firmly ensconced torches, flowed downwards in a tight spiral. Toby led the way, as stealth didn't seem to be an option in such narrow and bright quarters. We crept downstairs until we reached what was almost certainly a crypt. Sarcophagi lined the walls to our left and right, but the most interesting feature of the room was a thick, blood-red curtain directly in front of us. It seemed to divide the top of this chamber from the bottom of the next. There were people on the other side of the partition, conducting a rather loud and disturbing ritual of some sort.
"O demon lord of bargains, demon lord of contracts, demon lord of gain, O great Koroth," We beseech thee to strike the great bargain and bring about the end of days, that we might walk at your side and witness the subjugation of those unworthy of the final negotiation.
We traded glances with each other. Smaller and less stable religions had more than their fair share of doomsday cults, but what did any of this have to do with a plot against the royal family?
Oh, discoverer of hidden profit, our voices carry unto you in desperation. Rid this world of the poor and worthless, as they cannot afford the cost. Rid this world of the weak and stupid, as they cannot survive the culling.
As a group, we started to creep closer to the curtain. If we timed our charge right, we could catch these cultists by surprise. Assuming we could capture one of them alive, someone like an inner circle member rather than the clueless door guard upstairs, we would be able to interrogate them. Shock and awe was the best way to accomplish that.
Oh, broker of the first accord, please execute the divine loophole and send thine demonic servants to Panos. Allow the secret of the great contest to be known to thy servants. Raise the veil and allow us to see.
The thick red curtain shot up to the ceiling with such speed and power that we were helpless to do anything but watch. It must have been some sort of spring-loaded or counterweighted mechanism. Luckily, the contingent in the adjoining chamber was just as surprised as we were. Now would be a good time to explain something. Kuroth was fond of loopholes. Although the accord of the gods prevented demons, devils, angels, and avatars from occupying space on Panos, only the gods themselves could read the fine print. Koroth might not be able to send his demons to Panos, but he could enhance, reshape, twist, and reform residents of Panos into demon-like beasts. These were known as the Sacrificed of Koroth. Of the seven figures gathered in the opposite crypt, three of them were sacrificed humans. The first seemed to be fairly new to the fold. The only obvious mutation on him was a pair of bony nubs sprouting from the top of his bald skull. Clearly, someday these would be horns, but not today. The second creature was far worse off. The flesh of her fingers had been stripped away, and the bones filed into razor-sharp claws. The final sacrificed man could barely be recognized as a man at all. His skin was cherry red from being slowly baked in the unholy fires of Koroth's love. The creature's left hand was missing, and the bones of his wrist had been carved into a jagged spearhead. His two normal eyes were blind, but a grotesque third eye sprouted from the center of his forehead. Compared to those three, the two longsword-wielding psychopaths and curse-spitting clergymen seemed almost normal. Toby bellowed at the abominations, tears rolling down the sides of his golden-brown furred cheeks. I already knew that there was no retreat from this fight. For once, I got the jump on my foes, and it was actually effective. My web shot across the now conjoined room and glued one of the swordsmen and one of the priests to some nearby sarcophagi. As the men struggled to free themselves, Ames and Toby drew their weapons. Rick opted for a fast spell to hurl at the closest sacrifice. A volley of magic missiles pelted the deformed female, causing her to shriek and hesitate. Will started casting a longer, more complex spell, hoping to catch multiple opponents in a fireball. That was a mistake. The priest of Koroth finished a rapid incantation and flicked his hand towards Will in a slashing motion. A fountain of blood sprung from my friend's chest. He screamed with pain as a phantom force struck him. It was like a barbed bullwhip had cut a diagonal line through Will's robe and chest. He fell to his knees, spell never completed. Ames intercepted the robed human swordsman before he could reach the mage back line. The cat was so close to us, executing their normal dodging style would have opened us up to attack. So the werecat became an imposing presence, parrying, riposting like a fine fencer. With the screams of Will in his ears, the weeping minotaur bellowed and charged the sacrifices. The hesitating female was shouldered aside, still not in the fight. Toby lowered his head to engage the novice sacrifice, wanting to make an example out of him. Horns met bone nubs. Horns won. The creature's neck snapped back. Just in case he wasn't dead on impact, the lightning-quick flash of Toby's broadsword took his heart. Mid-beat. The crimson-skinned, spear-headed sacrifice was turning to charge Toby's flank. I quickly palmed the guts from my component pouch into my fingers and sent my acid bolts into his side. They impacted. Damage was clearly done as burnt flesh gave way to a pearly white ribcage on his right side. But it was as if the creature felt no pain at all. My webs were being torn through by the angry flash of a longsword. Those two would be freed soon, and the odds would be very much against us. Wisely, Will chose a purely defensive spell as his next incantation. Mirror image. Soon there were four Wills, all on their knees and bleeding. The female sacrifice leaped forward and slashed through the throat of one of the copies of Will. Luckily, it simply dissipated, as she guessed wrong on the first try. The priest that was free hurried to levy a curse against the Minotaur, attempting to strip him of the protections of Aro Remset. There was a brief dimming of the light in the room as the power of the gods themselves fluxed and contested. In the end, Toby looked no worse off, and the priest screamed in frustration. However, winning on the spiritual plane was only half the battle. The crazed sacrifice threw a powerful punch with its spear hand upon reaching Toby's side. The bullman couldn't raise his shield in time, and that jagged shard of bone penetrated chainmail and flesh alike. The paladin gasped as bone ground against bone, and his shield dangled limply from the straps. His shoulder was devastated, the nerves running up and down his arm numbed. But that didn't stop the enraged, teary-eyed Minotaur from twisting away and leveling his sword at this new threat. Ames was a contrast to the chaos happening all around them. Despite two of their friends wounded and crying out, despite two more foes breaking free of my webs, the werecat was a cool and calculated killer. The feline forced the swordsman into a desperate thrust. In a flash, three things happened. Sidestep, counterslash, and the swordsman's head tumbled to the stone floor. Rick, the priest, and myself all started incantations at the same time. It was going to come down to spell selection and target. Rick chose wisely once again, going for a quick spell, and one of my personal favorites. A force bolt sent the female sacrifice tumbling back into the opposite half of the crypt, just as those grotesque bone claws sliced at the face of Will's illusion, causing yet another to fade from reality. Unfortunately, the priest had been tracking which Will was likely the real one. Still rolling from an attempted dodge of the sacrifice's claws, the small human never saw the second blow coming. Again, the pain spell connected, flaying my friend's flesh open from left buttock to left shoulder blade. Will and his mirror image collapsed in pain, both laying on the ground, bleeding and twitching. I had opted for power. It was slow, and I was going to feel the drain keenly, but I knew that a second priest in this fight might mean the end of us all. Fur rubbed against brass, and the conduit was formed. Unwittingly, Rick had set up the perfect shot. Just as the second priest broke free of my web, the female sacrifice staggered into view. My lightning bolt fired, catching the sacrifice first. After the magic missiles and the force bolt, she had nothing left to resist the surge of electricity and fell to the ground, dead and smoking. The unfortunate priest that had been hobbled the entire fight found even more bad luck. My lightning bolt caught him once in the chest, rebounded off of a stone coffin behind him, and struck him again in the spine. His heart stopped, and he too fell. Ames smoothly picked up the swordsman, who had just freed himself, making sure to stay between him and our fallen ally. If anything, this one seemed less skilled than the last, quickly suffering minor cuts to the forearm and left hip. However, although I knew the werecat's blade was poisoned, the worshipper of Koroth showed no ill effects. Perhaps it was a perk of devotion to a demon lord. Toby gamely battled on with one arm and forced the veteran sacrifice back a couple of paces. He even scored a slash against the creature's collarbone, but the leathery skin didn't bleed. Soon after, that deformed bone spear of a hand drove downwards and into the Minotaur's left calf. The chain absorbed most of that blow, but still there was some penetration, blood, and pain. Toby was being picked apart. The priest had exhausted their complement of minor spells and decided that he had to take Rick out of the fight. Holding up a rod of iron, he pointed it at the tall human and started to call upon Koroth to invoke an unholy paralysis on the mage. Right at that moment, he probably didn't expect to meet a friend of mine. Rock. Rock impacted with the priest's face solidly, sending a pair of teeth flying. I stalked forward, following my own throw. I wasn't fully drained of intelligence at that point. I could have perhaps managed a minor spell or two without putting myself past the point of no return. But I was mad. Rick was mad too, but thinking far more clearly than I. He was moving forward as well, but fumbling with something in his belt pouch as he moved. From just 5 paces away, the human hurled a small clay pot at